Okay, we're back. Cameron McCune and Bob Dobbs. And this is episode number 46, being recorded on March 17th, 2022.
St. Patrick's Day.
We're moving. Yes, St. Patrick's Day is now. We're coming into it. And then tomorrow is the 13th anniversary of Ion. Ion arrived on March 18th, day after. But it was the night of St. Patrick's that I was talking to JW, and Dr. Beter came up, and I got an idea. Oh, I'd like to talk to Dr. Beter, who was dead. And that goal of talking to Dr. Beter accidentally evoked Ion the next day. So this was quite a monumental period. So I thought it was interesting. It starts on St. Patrick's Day, the evoking of the Ion level. So you're the first to point that out, except for me, who points it out to myself all the time. Okay, so I'm going back to the beginning. We're actually at page 87, but let me just explain a bit of what we've done in all these hours. We have gone to the end of the book and discussed the interview I did with the tech body, an actual recorded interview with something claiming it's a tech body, which is an interesting phenomenon in its own right. Now, my point is that McLuhan kind of anticipates the tech body if you include an understanding of Finnegan's Wake. So I begin the book basically describing McLuhan's more esoteric thinking about the global village, way beyond what people the cliches people think. For example, the Global Village started 150 years ago with the telegraph. Most people don't think McLuhan is going that far back when he starts. So on page 9, I start laying out all these quotes by McLuhan, and we have to go 80 pages, which is almost half the book, from 9 to 87 to get to the next phase, the Global Theater, which is in the 60s with the satellite proscenium arch. And we're just arriving for all these hours to part two, Global Theater. And then we're going to go into Global Membrane or Android Meme Phase 1, then Android Meme Phase 2, which is basically social media, Web 2.0, and then the anthropomorphical physical. And what else do I have after that? And then we go into the tech body, which we've already started to talk about and quoted the tech body in part 6. Now we're back in part 2. So I think that there's a lot of stuff on the Global Village that one should go through to pick the parts of McLuhan's thinking about the Global Village on into the Global Theater that anticipated the tech body, to help define where the tech body came from. So what do you think of that? Is that a good summary there?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I will say that my interest, if I want to distinguish it from yours, is more in the synchronic McLuhan, in the all-at-onceness, rather than these stages. And, of course, I believe we both intend the synchronic and the diachronic to be a kind of knot, and you have to understand both.
Yeah, K-N-O-T. K-N-O-T.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the connubium of being posts that we've discussed briefly at times, I try to show that one understanding of the global village is the plurality and interconnections of being itself, of ontology. And so in that sense, the global theater is not an advance on the global village. It's a derivative of the global village. That is to say that once the global village is understood ontologically, then the fact that human beings can do no more than fulfill roles from moment to moment to moment is obvious because human beings, of course, are in being, and they're, you could say they're vertically connected to the plurality of possibilities in being, and that interplay between being and beings is the global theater.
Yeah, and would you accept me saying that the global theater is an overlaying on the global village?
Sure.
Right.
Sure, because it's when you talk about overlaying, you're not saying that one is more real than the other or something. What you're saying is that what we're dealing with here are translucent surfaces through which the other can be seen.
Yeah, so, you know, Don Thiel recommended the word paramodern as opposed to postmodern, because he didn't think you completely left the modern, which is the telegraph era, so you have to include that. So we're doing para McLuhan here of his terms, of his themes, para McLuhan.
Sure, I don't mind that at all.
Yeah.
Or
para global village.
McLuhan, of course, himself often talked about para, usually in terms of paradox. Whenever he discussed symbol, he would talk about fact that in Greek, this has to do with some kind of throwing aside or creating what might be called a project or a a metaphor, right? So for McLuhan, concept of symbol the thrust is a better word than concept. The thrust of symbol has to do with para.
Yeah, metaphor, carrying across. Didn't he say that the symbol, the word meant throwing together?
Yes, but you can only have something thrown together when you realize its distinction.
Yeah.
Right? So I don't know if this is the right time to talk about it, but I wanted to, at some point today, I wanted to bring up what you were talking about, at least briefly on the website, about Ian and the tech body.
Okay.
Together in 11.
Yeah, that is right. A private session. Yes, I call the tech body is now 11:11, and what that means is Ian used to say that there was Ion, and then this tech body started coming in. So out of 11 parts, it used to be 8 parts Ion, 3 parts tech body. Then over the last couple of years, tech body started eating up and catching up to it got to 5-5. That's within 11 parts. 6-5, 5-5. And then a few months ago, the tech body moved ahead, and so it was like 6-5 for the tech body. Then he started saying 11-11. That's two groups of 11, it sounds like. And I think Ion means, I've talked to him about it, sometimes Ion is not exactly clear unless you do some more talking, but it means that they're pretty well intertwined of equal, quote, strength and contrast. Mm-hmm. Ion and
right.
Tech body, they're both 11-11. So
right.
That's what you're referring to.
Yes. And let me give you my reading or my hearing of what's going on there. So 11 is a prime number. Right, so the and by prime number, of course, we mean 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11. These are the prime numbers are numbers that are not divisible into other numbers.
Yeah.
And I'm not a mathematician, unfortunately. I wish I knew much more about this, but in advanced mathematics, the prime numbers play a prime role. It turns out that the prime numbers, as opposed to numbers just of prime and non-prime numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, turns out that the prime numbers have laws of their own, and those laws of the prime numbers are essential for understanding mathematics and for understanding the application of mathematics to the world. So what I find interesting about 11 is that it's a prime number, and by prime, I understand that it's elemental. So if we think about the 1 and the 1 that make up 11, we can imagine that there are two forces which could be seen to kind of march through the prime number possibility. So if we put it in your terms of tech body and ion forming different combinations to come to 11, so 6 and 5, 4 and 7, all this sort of stuff, we can imagine that the combination of the two has a number of essential possibilities which are gapped from each other. So the 4 and 7 is essentially different from, say, 6 and 5. So what the different possibilities lying within 11 tell us about are different elemental possibilities gapped from each other, and which can be signified by 11, because you have the two 1 strokes that do not coalesce. They're gapped.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the 1 and the 1 in 11 can be imagined as emphasis strokes. Right? So
emphasis strokes or spokes?
Yeah, strokes.
S-P. And
I'll explain what stroke, S-T-R-O-K-E-S.
Oh, okay.
What I mean by that is, if we think about 4 and 7 as one of the possibilities lying within 11, the 4 and the 7 can be imagined as two kinds of emphasis. That is to say, the 4 might be a certain emphasis of the tech body, and the 7 would be a corresponding emphasis of ion. So the 11 is not only a possibility in itself, it's also the general possibility that's always there. That is to say, every single possibility within 11 is two strokes of emphasis.
That's
so
the
you
structure.
Have 11 and,
that's the
yeah,
structure.
You have 11 and 1, 10 and 1, 9
yeah.
and 2, right? Each one of those is a double emphasis stroke. One belonging to ion, one belonging to tech body.
Right.
And the 11 is not only a possibility in itself, it's also the possibility of every other possibility.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
and so what's being set out here is the, you could say it's the metaphysics of the possible forms of being. And that is the connubium of being, the global village of being.
Yeah.
It's all of the possibilities, like 11 and 0, 10 and 1, 9 and 2. Those are, you could say, those are the villagers, plural, that each one of which is essentially gapped from the next one. That is to say, they have a fundamental reality that can never be taken away.
Yeah, very
and
good.
Their link is a gap which is even deeper than those possibilities.
Yeah.
And according to the best thinkers of the tradition, the reason that we have not had communication, real communication, so that it could be applied to the world, The reason that we have not had communication about the possibilities in being is that in order to grasp those possibilities, you have to first of all have grasped the gap between them that is even deeper than they are. And that gap is one that is, you can call it death, you can call it the origin of life, you can call it many different things, but it's a very fearsome thing to encounter. But unless it's encountered, you can't get from the ordinary world to the world of fundamentals.
Yeah.
Because, go ahead.
You remind me, last episode, I think I was trying to remember the two words, complementary and this other word. I couldn't remember it that McCone uses. I found out later, incommensurable. They're complementary and incommensurable. See,
right.
That implies a kind of gap that's a problem, the incommensurable.
Yeah. Well, it's a problem in some senses, but it's also the secret.
Yeah.
Right. It's also what makes language possible. It makes the world possible.
Makes consciousness possible. Consciousness.
Sure.
Possible?
All of the above.
Yeah.
Language, consciousness, but even the world itself.
Right.
Because
right.
If there were not a what might be called an original gap, if there were just sort of a blank. Which is kind of the wrong question that much of science is currently asking. They're asking how can we understand that an original blank through a Big Bang became the universe? But the problem is that there was no original blank. There was an original complexity of which the universe is an expression.
Correct. Ion used to, the number 11 came up years ago in the beginning. After a few years, Ion began to joke that our show, Bob's show, had 11 listeners. He always emphasized 11, which in your terms is a good beginning point. The complexity at the beginning is there's 11 listeners.
Yes,
11.
You can say that.
Yeah, and out of that comes the further sophistication. The other thing was, or complexities or resolutions, that when we first asked Ion what it was, at first I thought it was an entity or a group of entities, like the Evergreens channel by Michael Blake Reed, who I used to talk to McLuhan through, or something claiming to be McLuhan. Mm-hmm. So I said, how many entities are you, Ion? And Ion said, you take a dodecahedron, which is the fourth platonic solid, and you take an angle on it, and imagine 500 or 1,000 entities on one line, one angle. Then you do another shift to another angle, and then add another 1,000. So he said, you add them all up, the angles that make up a dodecahedron. And I said, well, that would be millions, because Michael Blake Reed had 6,500 to 7,000 entities. So I said, well, this is way more. And Ion says, no, zillions. So he corrects my millions to zillions. So that is the complexity that we begin with Ion. And then we found out that Ion was not the entities. Ion was the container of what is known as the guf in Jewish religious literature. The guf was the place for souls went to, so it was like a heaven. Souls, when they died, went to heaven, to the guf. So Ion said they were the guf, or they contained the guf, and they weren't the entities. So as you talk about the complexity in the beginning, in the so-called origin, that is the dodecahedron in Ion's terms, and all that's implied by it.
Sure.
So
you can see in what you're talking about that there's many different ways, many different levels, many different types of figuration through which one can approach these questions. Right. So if you talk about the guf, that is a kind of a literalization of something that can also be talked about in terms of prime numbers.
Yeah.
Or it can also be talked about in terms of Platonic solids. So the all of these are ways that human beings have tried to configure their fate. And one of the things that we're attempting to do, I think, in our conversations is that we're attempting to carry on that interrogation that has always characterized human beings on the earth.
No, correct. I want to say to listeners, we started off talking about Cameron's recent essay called The Canubium of Being. You should read that. Have you done any more on that? Have you added another part?
I don't know that I've added another part, but I have added footnotes and tried to clarify some pieces. I've mostly been concerned about the war in Ukraine the last few weeks, but what work I have done at the blog has been concentrated on that post.
Okay, so I'm recommending people, you just go to McLuhan Sciences, just Google that, and you'll get to Cameron's site, and then it's like at the top on the right corner at home, the latest essay, Canubium of Being. And that's what we've got to in this series, that we got to page 190 of War and Peace and Global Village, where the Canubium is discussed. And then Karen found some other places it was said in the 60s by McLuhan, different articles. So that's what we got to before we start going into global theater, or it goes with the global theater, because it's the Canubium Being is in the book where McLuhan now talks about the global theater, even though the title of the book is War and Peace in the Global Village. But he's pointing out the theatrical part that year in 68 in the Dew Line, his executive newsletter. And I don't know if there's any mention of the word global theater in War and Peace in the Global Village. I don't think so. But it comes out in, like, August 68. And he started the newsletter in July 68, and within a couple of months, he's talking about the global theater. So I guess he was wrapping up the global village with that book and moving into a new overlaying or a synchronistic echo of the same themes with new words.
Right.
Let's see what else I want to mention. Yeah, so I find McLuhan helps to understand Ion, and Ion helps to understand McLuhan, the subtleties in either direction. They're both very different languages and approaches, but they actually sometimes come pretty close in their sophistication or in their describing the new magic that's afoot that is hypnotizing people. So then, you've been thinking about the war. What are you thinking? How do you begin to think about it? Because there's so much noise around it. How do you approach that?
Well, I tend to see it in terms of a battle between multipolarity and unipolarity.
The unipolar versus the bi or multipolar.
Yeah.
So which is Putin?
I don't like to characterize people in terms of their mask, the masks that they're wearing, as if to imply that. You know, one of them is Saint George, and the other is the dragon.
Yeah.
One of the problems with the war is that it's being characterized as a struggle of good and evil.
Yeah.
And that prevents understanding. Instead, it's there are complex motivations on both sides, but I think what we see in the war is an unraveling
Of war.
Well, that would be good if that really happened.
And what I would add to that is there are many more people or thinkers or consciousnesses in the planet that are aware of this problem that you're talking about, the good and evil mistake, the fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
And probably never has there been so many people who include that. You could say it's kind of a collective consciousness that's happening as a result of this global membrane we're in, or even the tech body, that this is a new factor. And it's very hard for the Manichaeans to get anybody to agree on the terms and who's what, who's George and who isn't.
Correct. And it's it's like I was saying before, that you can't get to the fundamentals of anything without first understanding the gap that separates fundamentals.
Yeah. The gap between war and peace, you mean?
Well, not only between war and peace, but between war and what it's expressing. So as you were just pointing out a minute ago, the understanding of this war has many different possibilities.
Yeah.
So you could have a Manichaean understanding, or you could have an understanding that sees through the Manichaean understanding and arrives at a different understanding.
Yeah.
So there's the whenever we come to think about war, we have already activated some possibility of that understanding. So if people are beginning to see through the propaganda of good versus evil, what that means is they're beginning to understand a certain confusion that enters into our thinking as soon as we understand that things are not so fixed, are not so defined as we had thought they were. So it's the confusion that can possibly lead to truth. We have to leave aside the previous understanding, say between war and peace, and go to a new understanding. And that's exactly what I was trying to talk about with the 11 a minute ago. The 11 is gapped. And so the movement has to be from, we have two strokes there, two ones that make up 11. And each one of those ones has a myriad different understandings, which is correlate to understandings of the other one. So, for example, if one understanding of 11 is 0 and 11, in order to get to the understanding of 11 of 1 and 10, you have to transverse the gap between those two possibilities.
Hmm.
So, same with war. The different understandings of war are differentiated from each other by what appears to be confusion. But really, that confusion is what needs to be entered into like a labyrinth. And through that transversing of the labyrinth, we come to a different understanding of war. And that's what's at stake in what's going on in Ukraine, which I think is what you just said.
Yeah. Now, as you've been watching, we haven't talked in a month. How do you express your involvement with it when you say you've been not thinking about the Kenobi of being, but and not writing anything new? You've been concerned, or you had some verb in there about the war. What are you doing in that process? Are you just watching reports and yelling at the screen that they got it wrong?
Yeah. Well, you could say that, but I mean the big question posed by Western civilization is how to identify fundamentals and then go from fundamentals to their practical application in life. So just to take an example, Aristotle in the Politics talks about the different forms of government. And
okay, so Aristotle, is that something you did the past few weeks? You looked up Aristotle, so it's fresh
no,
in your mind?
No.
It's just coming to your mind now.
Yeah, as okay. a way of talking about what we're talking about.
Yeah.
What Aristotle says is that there's a dynamic between different forms of government, and each one taken to an extreme gives birth to another. Right? So you can have government by a dictator, you can have government by a group that sort of aristocrats, you could say, or at least people with combined power, and then you can have a democracy. And all of these three forms have good types and bad types. And the what happens to them all is that the good type of anyone seems to go over to the bad type, which then gives birth to a whole other type. And so you have a kind of dynamic of history.
Yeah.
So what's happened in the modern world...
Now, the synchronic view of that literate linear history is the sphere, an echo chamber, right? When you're describing one thing shifting to another thing, and then to a bad, and then that creates
sure.
a newness. Those are echoings in a sphere? That's synchronic?
Well, you could say that. You could say that. It's what I was just talking about is confusion.
Yeah.
Right? What lies between fundamental possibilities is not itself a fundamental possibility.
Right? What lies between fundamental possibilities is not itself a fundamental possibility. Is that what you just said?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that's to understand that really goes to the heart of everything. Right? If being is a connubium, that is to say, if it is a plurality, if it is something like a global village, then there needs to be separate entities in that village, or it couldn't be a village. So in order to have separate entities at the level of being, there needs to be abysmal borders between them. Right? If you don't have borders, you can't have plurality.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about a plurality of fundamental things, then the gap between fundamental things is deeper than fundamentality.
Mm.
That is to say, it's abysmal. So you could say that human beings are the animal that has an intuitive understanding through language or in language of its abysmal connection, right? Humans are the animal that understands that it's going to die. So there is an intuitive understanding in human beings of this gap in which they are situated. But it's a very fearsome thing to go into that labyrinth.
Mm.
So the great task that is posed to Western civilization is to understand through that labyrinth the possibilities of being and then to apply them. And since Plato and Aristotle, arguably from thousands of years before that, human beings have had this task of applying fundamentals to their individual being and to their society, but they've failed to do it. And so here we are in 2022, and the world has thousands and thousands and thousands of nuclear bombs. And the failure, the recurrent failure to be able to apply fundamentals has come to haunt us. It's something that we need to do or we're going to be skunked. And that's something that McLuhan said over and over and over again, that he was attempting to understand the possibilities of survival. And if we didn't understand the possibilities of survival, then we were going to destroy ourselves.
So you look at this spectacle and last few weeks, what are you prompted to say or write? What you're saying to me now?
Well, sort of, but human beings are dumb, stupid, dumb in the sense of stupid, and weak. So I think about my own stupidity and my own weakness. Mm-hmm. I wish that I had been better able in my life to think about these issues so that they had better application, right? I'm a guy that sits around and I write about this stuff and I think about this stuff, but it's weak and powerless. I'm one more person that should have done more, but I've been unable to do it.
Well, you're doing a good job at catching up for your slack years. You may not catch up, though. But I don't know what you mean by elementals. Could you begin to explain that a little bit, what you mean by them? You know, McLuhan used to say back to basics, which was media study, the language of forms, or the ground. He had all these different terms.
Right.
That's what you mean by fundamentals, right, what he was pointing to with those words.
Yes. Yes. So ground for McLuhan is not singular but plural, and ground also never stays as ground. It becomes cliche, and cliche becomes ground, back and forth and back and
right.
back and forth. So the there's a confusion about ground or fundamentality into which people need to enter if they are to truly understand ground or fundamentals. And so one of the things I'm attempting to do with the blog is I'm attempting simply to keep alive those sorts of considerations.
Yeah.
If I could find the secret of application, if I could find the secret of actually communicating with people, that would be tremendous. That would be sort of the end goal. But that it may be that that's something too big for me.
And you don't mean becoming famous, and then you're talking on this week in the news. You don't mean that when you say, could you get more people talking with you, responding to what you have to say? So what do you
mean? Well, I mean, what you just said is almost the tragedy of McLuhan, right? McLuhan came to his central ideas around 1960, and just as he was coming to a formulation of them, he had his first major stroke and damn near died and had the last rites read to him. So he then spent 20 years, the 60s and the 70s, knowing that he was very sick, knowing that he was going to die, and trying to figure out, well, how do I communicate this stuff? And so one of the ways in which he tried to communicate it was to become famous, to become a talking head, but it didn't work. So one of the ways to interrogate McLuhan is to interrogate the ways that he attempted to communicate and see what was wrong with them, and hope that, and coming to an understanding of how that didn't work, hope that that will lead to something that will work.
Yeah. There were different times when I spoke to him, I got the impression that he knew that. He knew that it might not work. You know, he wasn't, oh boy, if I get to be a talking head out there, I'll get something done. He knew that it was a problem. I remember in 71, I was at the coach house, and Morris, his brother, who was working the front desk, you know, receiving visitors and all that, he says to me, out of the blue, he says, we've decided to retreat a bit. So this is in 71, after he's getting a lot of bad press in 69 and 70. And, you know, and Liz Jeffries wrote a PhD on this period. Jonathan Miller's book came out in 71. Don Thiel's book came out in 71. There was something else in that period. And plus, he'd been at the Bilderbergers, and they weren't interested in him anymore. So...
There were a whole lot of very negative reviews of his stuff, saying that he was a moron and stuff.
And just repeating himself, no new no new thrilling new novels or something, you know. They were expecting endless surface creativity. Yet he was harping on the same issues, which is probably more significant than all the books that Norman Mailer wrote or anybody else, you know. He stuck
exactly to and continually making mistakes.
Right.
So his references were wrong, or he didn't even know how to spell, or on and on like that.
So Moore says to me, we've decided to retreat. We're not going out there doing conferences or something like that. You know, we're going to stay here locally. Now, that was around the time of the Spadina Expressway battle he got involved in locally. I think that movie was made in 69 or 70. Burning Wood, I think it was called, for a line from Finnegan's Wake, or a couple of words. So I thought that was incredible. They had a very conscious understanding of their image and the effects of going out, which you've been doing for 2 or 3 years, and you have that conversation with the board of the University of Toronto that I got sent to me, you know, a few years ago. And where he's talking to Bissell and everybody who's ever on the board there, and they're aware McLuhan has become famous. It's 69. The student radicalism is happening. And McLuhan, they're talking about, well, if we do this, what will happen? This could be a problem. He said, well, I'm a good example of that. I went out there, and look what happened. It failed. You know what I mean? Nothing but confusion. So he even says it among his bureaucratic colleagues at this point. So he was aware of the problem of the communication, but he didn't stop. You know, he didn't go into despair. He came up with new dialectics.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And look at how that applies to today, right? We have websites in Toronto and Winnipeg and other places, New York, which take up the what could be called the famous McLuhan gambit.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that by coining some new words and having them become famous, having them become typical expressions of the society, that way leads to communication. And so you have people taking up the, let's say, the 1971 McLuhan, whereas for him, there was a question embedded in that stance that these websites exclude.
Yeah.
And so the problem that McLuhan had in the 70s is now emerging in the websites about McLuhan.
Yeah.
They miss this gap, this confusion, this questionability, which is at the heart of his thinking.
Yeah, way back in the 80s when I started spearheading the McLuhan revival, half unconsciously, just knowing that he was not being included in the public dialogue, at least in Toronto, enough. So I made a point of going public with it. I'd always, within every couple of shows, apologize for doing this. Because I knew I was creating more confusion or some unforeseen effects. So I was always showing a consciousness of what I was doing and not saying, wow, isn't it neat what I'm doing, and you guys need to know this and follow me and we'll get somewhere. I pointed out the problems of communication, which is what you're always emphasizing. I did that all through the years. So I congratulate myself, at least in your terms. But, you know, you're saying these others aren't doing that.
Yes, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, to my way of thinking, we've kind of got different McLuhan masks put up without understanding what masks entail, without understanding what the global theater entails. So that is a good introduction to where you are in your book now.
Yeah, and I think we honestly, sincerely, transparently believe that we are maybe offering the best McLuhan mask going, because we include all these, he used to call them elephant traps and tiger cages. You know, we are more conscious in admitting our fallacies than anybody else is. I think other people are just trying to get gigs as consultants or something.
Yeah, get tenure or
get,
there's lots of things that can be got for being a leading intellectual.
Okay, so what else is there to say about that? I like you talking about this. Now, we've talked about this many times, about the problem. So looking at the situation, what is there a sentence or two where you could say what is being missed in the media commentary, or is there even media commentary because there's so much of it, it all just cancels itself out? Is there something for you to talk to out there?
Well, I don't know that I would say that because the 99% of the quote-unquote media coverage is just crap. It's words. It's like McLuhan's note to Pound in 51 where he says that the word has become the problem.
Yeah, it's a
and
new that, drug.
That's what the... Yeah, that's what the reporting of the war is near useless because it's all moralized. It all it attempts to present the war, including every little detail of the war, as an incident in a struggle between good and evil. So one of the things I do in my blog is I try and talk about Nietzsche a lot. Because Nietzsche foresaw all of this stuff. He foresaw that when the word dies, then morality doesn't die because human beings are the moral animal. So what happens is the morality, although it's obsolete, becomes superabundant, just like McLuhan said about the book or the car. So what happens when morality becomes superabundant, but it is no longer moral? Well, that's the reporting we have in the war right there.
Yeah, I remember Croker, after he did his book on McLuhan, Grant, and Innes in 84, he then did a book on the postmodern scene where he confronted the new fad in academia of what was called post-structuralism or simulation, postmodern studies. They put out a book, his press put out a book on the new value, the excessive valuation or the concern over values that
right.
was happening, which would be the arguing, I guess, over content in McLuhan's terms. The valuation, the excessive valuation is what you mean of moral beings keep on jabbering even though the language has died. You would,
yeah, but they, it's the... the reign of woke, right? It's the reason that the reactions to the war are so extreme is that people believe that they are participating in a war of good and evil, and the whole meaning of their life on Earth becomes involved in their valuation of the war.
Yeah. So
it's very, very dangerous. Because if you have people that are willing to bet everything on a fallacy, then you're really screwed up. The reason that McLuhan is so good in talking about fallacies is that he does not believe that there is one such thing that is a fallacy. He believes that all things are fallacies.
Yeah.
And once you know that, then you're away from woke.
Yeah, and he included himself. He said to Woody Allen, "You think my whole fallacy is wrong."
Yeah.
There might be an aspect of clarity in that he's pointing to that he has. You think my whole fallacy is wrong. Well, maybe there's a part of it that isn't. Isn't that what he's saying?
Sure. I mean, he's making the whole idea of good and evil into something complex. And anything that's complex, as we were saying earlier, leads down into a fundamental confusion that exists between fundamentals.
Well, what do you think of the response, which I tend to do, is I don't follow any of it. I'm not processing the information. I recognize you can't totally turn off the processing because it gets it gets into your experience in other ways, through other media or something. What do you think of the strategy of not engaging in the coverage? Because McClellan used to point out that the coverage was bigger than the war back in the Vietnam War days.
Sure, and that's even more true today.
Yeah, so is that a fundamental, recognizing that there's more coverage than the incidents, the content, the events, and that one should always apologize for engaging the little bit of content you're engaging?
Sure, because I think a minute ago you said something like, coming to a conclusion or coming to an understanding through the coverage.
Yeah.
But you see, that's a linear Gutenbergian sense, right, which you were rightly criticizing.
Yeah.
So if people think that what they have to do in regard to the war is come to a moral understanding about it, then they have already fundamentally misunderstood what was at stake.
So the so what do you see in the commentary? I see people despairing. They certainly don't see that they can do anything about it, or they see the leaders are incompetent. There's no hope for people. They resolve to prayer, but they don't they give up in the public discussion. They recognize the noise, but they're so fascinated by it, they can't stop engaging it. They can't stop watching it, texting, worrying about it. They can't give up. Well, isn't that partly they can't die? They need to die, metaphysically.
Yes, I agree. People both understand and don't understand that there is a need both at the level of the world and at the level of their own individual being, there is a necessary transformation at stake.
Yeah.
And the transformation in the world and the transformation in the individual either will or will not happen. And that question is at stake for everybody.
Right, and that transformation is probably not any known cliche version of transformation that is sold or propagated or institutionalized. There's a new kind of transformation that's required.
That's right, or you could say not only a new kind of transformation, but by definition, a new kind of transformation into something new.
Yeah.
Because anything that is essentially new, that is to say, something that requires an essential transformation, and this is something we were talking about the whole time we've talked today, anything that requires an essential transformation to something that is essentially new cannot be seen in advance, cannot be seen through the rearview mirror. It requires a groping like a blind person, which is one of the reasons that McLuhan was always bringing up the book Let There Be Light, or whatever it was called, by Leverson.
Jacques Le Guérin? What was the name of that guy?
Leverson or something like that. I can't remember his name at the moment.
Jacques Valleyrand or something. Anyways, yeah, and there was Light, the blind guy.
So and McLuhan also talked about this in many, many different sort of images. So one of the ways he talks about it is a thief who's trying to break into a safe, and the thief has to use his or her sense of touch to understand on the combination dial they've reached some point where the dial has to be turned in the other direction. Right? So for McLuhan, understanding means going back and forth and back and forth in an attempt to open a safe. Right?
Yep.
And that, this going back and forth and back and forth is what we were just talking about.
Listening for when the tumblers fall, he would say.
Exactly, exactly, exactly.
So I looked up the guys. Jacques Lucy ran, and I've never seen a picture of him. There's a picture of what I got here on Wikipedia, which is interesting.
And
He lived from 1924 to 1971.
Yeah, yeah. And the tragedy of the guy is he died in a car accident.
Really?
And And imagine what it's like to be blind in a car, and you don't know what kind of driving is going on.
Yeah.
You don't know what kind of cars are coming up in the other direction. You don't know what kind of trees are around. And in that unknowing, suddenly there's a fatal accident and you're gone. So you go from what could be called a live blindness to a dead blindness.
Right, and it's appropriate that it happens to him, and there was light, because he was illustrating, you were citing him to illustrate how you have to move into the unknown. And he experienced
That's right.
it dramatically.
And how you have to use your hand to feel tactile differences, or you have to use your ear to listen to the what's going on with the tumblers.
Yeah.
Or you have to use your antennae to feel out into the unknown. McLuhan used all of those, and some of them he got from Wyndham Lewis.
Yeah. And the other men of 1914, he got a little from Peter Montgomery laid out what McLuhan got from Eliot, what he got from Joyce, what he got from Lewis, what he got from Pound and Yeats, five of the guys. It was a nice pattern. As a matter of fact, it would be interesting. Can I quickly bring that up? I know I saved it, categorized it. So let's see. Still looking, just a second. So, sure, the fragment, sure, there it is. So then I'll put this in. Looking.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should do a conversation on this some other time, and in the meantime, we could find the link and read it and think about it, because this topic of what he got from the men of 1914 is a very rich one and a very important one.
Yeah, okay, so I'll send that to you when I get it. So the you were saying that he got from Lewis what? What was the aspect that he got from Lewis?
I was talking about the different metaphors that McLuhan used for how probing works.
Mm.
Right, and the idea of the artist being the antennae of the race, I believe that comes from Lewis.
No, antenna of the race is Pound.
Oh, yeah? Okay, good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, I'm starting to say to people, McLuhan said, I don't explain, I explore. And I said, I don't explore, I explain. I'm flipping back.
Well, both imply each other.
Yeah.
Right. It would, if somebody understood explaining and exploring as two different things, as good and evil, then they wouldn't understand either one.
Yeah.
Right, so that's why when I was talking about ion and 11, the interesting thing about the two ones in 11 is that when they're used as markers, let's say in 4 and 7, then that's essentially different from their use in 11. And that to understand that difference is the only way to understand what 11 is about.
Yeah, now, you've read a lot of Derrida. He talks about the mark or the trace. Is that what you're discussing here? The two ones? It's not the mark and the trace.
No, I don't think so, because I'm certainly no expert in Derrida. I haven't read Derrida for decades.
Because I thought
that he was mostly spinning his wheels.
That
just ceased to be interesting to me when I started to read him in the late 1960s or the early 1970s. I read him as offering a kind of challenge to thought. But here, Derrida was saying, here are the problems. Try and think your way through these. And so I found him as very valuable as a challenge, but not valuable as somebody who had taken up that challenge very well himself.
Right. Did you go to symposia that featured him?
I went to symposia where he had made presentations, but I wasn't there at the time that he made the presentations.
Right, so you never met him?
No.
You never had a chance to...
But I knew people that were quite close to him, mm-hmm. and I had great respect for those people that I knew and had friendships with. So I always suspected, because I had this respect for these people that had studied with Derrida and were friends with Derrida, because I had great respect for them, I always thought that there was more to Derrida than I was able to see.
Mm.
So I don't, just because I don't find his work personally enlightening, doesn't mean that I don't suspect that there's something more there that I don't understand.
Right. Okay, so we ended the last episode with me quoting the beginning of the Global Theater section, where I'll just repeat it. McLuhan became famous for his phrase, Global Village, but not so well known at the time was his phrase during the late 60s, the Global Theater, which meant the satellite technology of the 60s had turned the global city or megalopolis into an art form.
Right. So let's just... That paragraph is a very, very good paragraph in my view.
Yeah.
So let's just tease that apart a bit. The you say here that the global city had been turned into an art form.
Yeah.
And that art form we can say is the global theater.
Yes.
Right. So what happens is that the when McLuhan is talking about the global village. People, even today, take him to be talking about, well, I can phone Nairobi and I can find out what's going on there. And they take the physical world and the tangible media as the content of what McLuhan is talking about. But what McLuhan had to do in reaction to that was say, no, all of our understandings of media, all our understandings of the physical world, the Nairobis and the Mumbais and all that stuff, all of these things are always seen in some particular perspective. And the only way that we can really get an understanding of what's going on in the global village is to understand the roles through which the global village is understood.
Mm.
So that movement which you call turn the global village into an art form. That's understanding the roles or the perspectives or the characterizations or the biases through which the global village is always understood.
Yeah, there's a letter early 60s, 61 or something, where he talks about air traffic controllers, and he says that
good point.
Yeah, the lack of sophistication in the global village needs a new city, a center of sophistication, which he means,
that's,
you know,
right,
media ecology awareness.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's
so
a
we
letter
needed
to Jackie Tirwitt from December 1960.
Right. Maybe you want to read the last paragraph or section?
I don't have letters in front of me here. I just
you remember that date.
I just remember it as being a very important letter.
Yeah, yeah. And he's saying we need to build a city. So that's the global city, which was a messy form that was there, imminent or imminent pervasive, that sense of imminent, you know, pervades. It's there, and we need to make ourselves conscious of the global city so we have a new sophisticated zone that's not subject to the rubes of the role players in the global theater who are bumping around and creating all kinds of unforeseen effects. So he said, it's not a literal city. Imagine a air traffic controllers programming the planes and the media coming in and out and orchestrating survival in that situation, so nobody crashes too much into something else. So that's what I was thinking. I think he says in that letter, the global city is what we're looking to make, and that's what I'm referring to when I say art form, turn the global city into an art form.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
And he's actually, in 1960, he's actually coming back to a point that he made, I think it's in 1954, in a letter to Walter Ong. And what he says to Walter Ong is that what we're trying to do, Walter, is build a census communis for the world.
Yeah.
So McLuhan spent the 1950s, you could say, trying to understand what happens as soon as we understand the multiplicity of media.
But also the co-anesthesia, you know, Thiel's term. Because in 64, in the Burroughs Review, he talks about one can program the whole environment now. It's pharaonic. You're a pharaoh. We're all becoming pharaohs. That's what he was proposing to Ong. Let's provide a census communis for the whole world. We can do it. As the new pharaoh effect.
Right. We can do it, and there could be a new pharaoh, but even though we can do it, we aren't doing it, and there is no new pharaoh.
Yeah.
So what McLuhan is saying is, I can intuit this possibility, but trying to define the possibility, trying to communicate the possibility, trying to apply the possibility is something that I need to think through. And he spent the next almost 30 years hammering away at that and didn't succeed.
Would he say, as a Christian, that of course he wouldn't succeed? Man can't solve it. He has to go to the transcendent. Whatever that means.
No, there's a the problem with that is that it you're using the word succeed in a Gutenbergian way.
Yeah, I
can. So to succeed doesn't mean to consolidate, to have no doubts, to reach the final illumination or something.
Yeah,
to succeed would involve blindness, inability, finitude, etc. But it would at the same time show that these limitations are not somehow opposed to truth. So if you think in terms of the 11 that we were talking about, the 11 as a prime number is fundamentally different from 10 as a non-prime number, but it's also fundamentally different from 7 as another prime number. So the understanding of 11 means leaving aside an understanding of 10 or of 7 as the guide, as potential guides to 11.
Yeah.
The understanding of 10 and 7 needs to come from 11, right? So there's a kind of jump that's involved here, a jump to 11 and a jump back from 11. And the what's needed for communication and the application of these ideas to the world is tremendously complicated. I mean, it's defeated the greatest minds of the tradition for thousands of years. But we've reached a point in the world where we have to do that.
Yeah. Do you think you could say he was a success if he passed it on and he passes away and there's a successful continuation equal to what he was doing?
Well, I wouldn't use success in that sense, but I would say that people like you and I are attempting in our own ways to continue something that we see in him.
Yeah.
And just as he wasn't entirely successful, at least in my case, I don't want to speak for you, but at least in my case, I also won't be completely successful. So it's part of the human condition to be less than perfectly successful. There is no such thing as perfect success for humans.
So, but then you use the words that we must do a transformation, a new kind of transformation. We have to overcome that limitation somehow.
Well, I wouldn't say overcome the limitation. I would say enter into it better.
Okay, enter into it better. Does that mean getting the correct terms or just knowing when the terms serve and then they don't serve, so you get new terms?
Yeah. All of the above. All of the above.
It's interesting. If Joyce was trying to have all of the above in Finnegan's Wake, you know, it took him 17 years to feel that he got a lot in there to get to the problem that your origins, which had contained so many capacities, potentialities, he tried to show, draw, paint the makeup of that origin point. So he put everything in it. Every language, every idea, every game, every response, every stupidity. He just kept piling it in. So,
correct. But notice how that disables the term origin point.
Yep.
It turns out that the whole notion of the point needs to be exploded, needs to be seen as something laughable. So to get back to how people are looking at the war in Ukraine, people have a moral need to reach a point of view about it. They need to situate it on a moral spectrum, you could say. And what they want to do is they want to reach a certain point of good as opposed to evil that is no longer questionable. Well, all of Finnegan's Wake is a demonstration that that's ludicrous, that's a funny goal to have and should be given up.
So are there services to remain in this tense moment that the world thinks it's in? Keep it going? Force people to stay focused?
I didn't understand what you were saying there.
The tension the world apparently is in, there's a lot of suspension, like yourself. You're not writing your articles. You're paying attention to something going on that is critical or a threat. Would there be a service to maintain that threat, that Putin doesn't make a move, Americans don't make a move that moves it to what they are worried about, some almost nuclear level. This tension is an art form that forces everybody to do what we're doing, talking and thinking about it, more than they ever did.
You could say that. Yeah. So if we want to get back to 11 for a second, the 11 is possibility that has that includes all of the other possibilities, like 1 and 10, 2 and 9, 8 and 3, etc. So trying to understand what 11 represents is a very healthy exercise, and the hope is that by interrogating 11, a transformation can take place whereby the confusions and difficulties implicated in 11, instead of preventing understanding, instead of driving understanding to try to understand 11 as only one, you could say that the whole Gutenberg galaxy is the attempt to take 11 and to take the one on one side or the other and consolidate it into a single point, right? Into a one instead of an 11.
Hmm.
But once the 11 is understood in its complexity, once the gap is introduced between the ones to bring about the 11, right, as opposed to the one, once that 11 is understood as something inherently problematic because of the gap between the ones through which alone 11 can be, that confusion and that difficulty is what needs to be understood, not overcome, but taken on, and through that applied. And the great question that's being urged by that war is whether or not humans can learn that lesson. I hope so. And I think that's what you mean by burying the tension.
Yeah. So, I think I had a thought there, but it got lost in your endless paragraph there. but the...
My oblivating.
Yeah. What were you talking about?
The war, the 11.
I keep thinking how he ends Cultures Are Business by saying there is no finish line.
Correct.
It's the last line in the book.
Yeah.
What?
Well, look at that. How if you take the 11 as two lines, right?
Yeah.
So there is
no finish line.
Yeah. Singular.
No, yeah.
Right. There's two lines.
There's two lines. No finish line.
Yeah.
I still like to ask you, in your, are you just praying? You're hoping, as Ayn says, hope's not a strategy. What would you like to contribute to the situation other than what we're doing right now, which might be enough? What do you,
well, you see, I think, imagine, somebody who's in Constantinople in 1453, right? And the Turks are all around, and they're bombarding the walls with their big cannons and all that sort of stuff. What can the individual do? You know, the individual can go and try and get his neighbors not to despair, to come to the wall, to fight against the invaders and all that sort of stuff. Or the individual can sit around and try and think, well, is there some weapon that we might put together that would be able to fight against this threat or something? But oftentimes the individual is just overwhelmed. Cities do fall. Civilizations do fall. That's the way of the world. So it's not as if the individual should have an answer. It would be good to come up with an answer. It would be a very fine thing. But it's not very usual in the world for that to be the case.
Yeah. So that's well said. So let's see what I say in this book.
And by
here.
The way, we're in a certain way, what we're doing is we're mining your first paragraph there.
Yeah.
Because this transformation of the global village to the global theater means understanding all of the different aspects of the global village through all the different ways of understanding those aspects. So it's very, very, very complicated. But the idea of seeing the complications of the global village through the roles of understanding is this movement to the global theater. And it's more or less the conclusion that McLuhan came to when he said the medium is the message.
Yes.
That is to say that when people were saying, well, how can education be made relevant once again, which is one of the main questions McLuhan was trying to answer in the 1950s. When he says the medium is the message, what he's saying is if we understand all of the different ways that we understand the world in terms of roles, that is to say, in terms of media, that might be a way of coming to address these questions. And it's all there in your paragraph.
Yes. Would you take up arms and go over to Ukraine, volunteer?
No, because I don't see that number one as contributing, and I don't see which side you would go on.
Right. Now, if you were on Tucker Carlson or something saying that, you'd be considered a Putinite, right?
Yes.
How would you?
Yeah, any kind of introducing complexity into the situation is seen as propaganda. But of course, the whole idea that there aren't complexities is itself propaganda.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of labyrinth or maelstrom taking place here, but it's not recognized. Instead, there's a maelstrom, and the brothers on the boat with the mariner are saying, oh, look, we can go home this way. And the mariner's saying, no, there's a maelstrom there.
Mm.
And right now the brothers are taking us into the maelstrom.
Right.
And it won't survive.
Who won't survive? They won't.
The brothers.
Yeah.
And Poe's tail, it's difficult to know from his tail if there's one brother or more than one.
Right.
But seems like there's more than one other brother, and that the two other brothers both perish.
Right. So the if we do get to this point of no return, there will be survivors from it.
Maybe.
Do you think it's possible everybody could get wiped out?
Sure. And to me, the terrible thing there is, I mean, Western civilization and Eastern civilization, all civilizations are producing wonderful, wonderful stuff. And it would be a terrible thing for that to sort of go into the night and having amounted to nothing.
Yeah.
But even worse, in my view, is that if human beings wipe out themselves, they're going to wipe out all sorts of other life forms. And those life forms are innocent of what would be happening to them. And that would be a terrible, terrible thing to for human beings to do that to the world.
Well, does Christian faith say that one would survive that if you have
no.
the correct faith?
No, Christian faith says that the world may well destroy itself, may well disappear. Because if you take the Godhead, the Son of God is killed by the world and dies. And that death is a death that's more monumental than the death of the world.
Mm.
So the notion of the world killing itself, obviating itself, is not as difficult, you might say, as the death of God. So the in Christian thought, the fact that the world could kill itself and might indeed kill itself is a aspect of the monumental possibility of God himself dying.
Okay. So I then say, McLuhan, by the mid-60s, as can be seen in his correspondence with Sheila and Wilfred Watson, was perceiving a new environment of electronic process. We've been saying that. The interplay of cliches and archetypes, the essence of consciousness. So we've been explaining that. Then I do a little oral statement. It's very useful to know Barry Nevitt wrote the above sentence explaining consciousness, quoting McLuhan, when McLuhan was thinking about electronic process during the years he wrote the book From Cliché to Archetype, published in 1970.
Right.
So,
just to bring people up to date, we've been talking about electronic process as the inherent interplay between poles, between north and south poles, let's say. So the idea of electronic consciousness or the essence of consciousness as an electronic process is that thinking itself is dynamic, going between poles.
Yeah.
And those poles can, for example, cliche and archetype.
Yes. All right, very good. So then I say the separate media categories of his opinion no longer applied. So there he is realizing his categories in the 60s failed. So he's got to come up with new categories, which are cliche to archetype. And he's admitting he's doing an opinion, which is to justify the ways of God to people, to the tribe. That's how he defines opinion. It's not an epic. It's not a heroic story. It is an explanation of why humans fail, almost.
Right.
Justification.
So notice that the difference between an epic and an epilion is that an epic is a single linear story.
Yeah.
And an epilion is always stories, plural. So if we think of human beings in their achievement, that's one story, but the same quote-unquote achievement seen as failure is another story. So that's the difference between epic and epilion is that an epilion recognizes limits. You can't have different stories without limits between or limits or borders between those stories. So the whole notion of epilion, which McLuhan came to through Eric Havelock, the whole notion of epilion is that it has difference or discontinuity built into it. And then the application of that to human life is very obscure. And McLuhan came to think that maybe one way of explaining that is this dynamic between cliche and archetype.
Yeah. And epilion is spelled E-P-Y-L-L-I-O-N for
right.
people not familiar with the word. So I write the separate media, that's the 60s Understanding Media book, the separate media categories of his opinion, which was the two books, Gutenberg, Galassi, and Understanding Media, no longer apply. He called it intermedia. That was his new term. And that comes from the original book sleeve of From Cliché to Archetype. Not many people have seen that book sleeve. So it says on the book sleeve, quote, the book title, From Cliched Archetype, so they're referring to the book, From Cliched Archetype, is Marshall McLuhan's most important and definitive statement on today's culture and technology since Understanding Media. It goes way beyond the medium is the message theme into a scintillant study of the process of intermedia action. Now, isn't that interesting? He's recognized it failed. Now he's starting a new decade with a new, well, different approach to the same old problem. But he knows he must, was it, lie down in the garbage? And,
yeah.
You know, the Yates.
In the bone and the rag shop.
Yeah. Of the heart. He has to start over again. So that's interesting. I don't know if we have. Do many philosophers do that, announce that they blew it, and then start over again? Or is our time the only time when one could do that? There'd be enough.
No. That's always been known. The what you call blowing it can also be understanding some aspect of the labyrinth, which tells you to reverse course or to take a left turn or a right turn or whatever, right? So what you're calling blowing it can be revelatory.
Yeah.
So it's not the case that we're going on from, now I know that I was completely wrong and now I'm going to become completely right. It's a question of understanding limits. There one way of understanding has a natural limit, and it may be advantageous or it may be helpful to go to another understanding. Now, that other understanding will itself have limits, but everything that human beings do has limits. So it's just it's a question of understanding the different kinds of limits. And understanding the different kind of limits can be called understanding the different kinds of roles that people can assume. And that's the Global Village, the Global Theater.
Yes. So in footnote 40, the bottom of this page, what is that, page 87? Is that what
we're on?
Page 87. I have a good quote from Barry Nevitt from his book ABC of Prophecy, which he put out in 1980. The quote is, Marshall McLuhan foresees that consciousness, and consciousness is in quotes, Marshall McLuhan foresees that consciousness will prove to be an effect of speeding up cliche archetype processes in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Speeding them up. So we've been doing that, taking the cliches of McLuhan, putting archetypal force to it, and trying to wake get consciousness, and of course,
sure.
The three quarters, all kinds of.
Let's understand speeding up there in another way. When the people like Lavoisier and Priestley were trying to understand the elements of the physical world, and they came to isolate oxygen. And I think that happened in the 1780s. You could say that they were learning to speed up our perception of the relation between physical elements and the physical world. They were speeding them up in a way that jumped out of the old understanding into a whole new understanding. And so speeding up there isn't a linear acceleration that builds on, point after point after point. It's a jumping from one understanding of cliche and archetype to another. So if we understood all cliches as embodying archetypes and all archetypes as being themselves cliches, that's a completely different understanding of cliche and archetype from one that thinks of a cliche in terms of a certain term that is to be understood in some way by an archetype that is itself consolidated.
Yeah, so that image of speed up in movies, yeah. TV, the blur, they'll show speed up with the blur. That's yeah. not speed up. That's a linear speed
Correct.
Up. That's not the speed up we're talking about. It's a quantum leap is a popular phrase. It's the speed yeah. up we're talking about. Like he even said, with the radio environment, he only said this once, with the radio environment, we leaped, we evolved a million years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He often spoke of events of, and now people are saying this in regards to the war, by the way. A lot of people are talking about how history has sped up, how it's possible now to lead to experience a 10 years of events in a single day, something like that.
Yeah, people walking around here a month ago, here in the tourist paradise of Maui, did not know that they would be confronting the end of the world a few weeks later, you know?
That's right.
That's speed up.
Exactly right. Yes, sir.
So then I have another quote from just below, Barry's quote, Marsha McLuhan, Catherine Hutchin, and Eric McLuhan, City's Classroom. They say, a study of cliches, which when pushed to extremes, flip into archetypes and vice versa.
Absolutely. Yeah.
In both,
we often
both
talk
directions.
About figure and ground that way.
Yeah. That is flipping.
Yeah.
I think I saw a video in 1975 at TV Ontario where the student in the audience said, haven't we kind of gone past your movie is the art form, and then TV is art form, that sequence that McLuhan would do, you know, Plato turns oral culture into an art form by making a book, Socratic book. So this guy says, haven't we gone beyond that? And McLuhan says, oh, yeah, there's been many flip points since then.
Yeah.
Since the last one I mentioned, many, many flip points. we then go to, so he coined this new word, intermedia. So I say it's about the obsolescence of the medium as the message theme. And McLuhan turned it into a synthesis study of intermedia, not media and not understanding media. It was intermedia action, which meant, quote, we can't tell the difference between the message and the media. It's all tactilely blurred. Now, he never said those actual words, but that is the last phase when he's talking to the priest. And he says, I can't tell what is message or medium anymore. So I just summed it up with this colloquial statement. We can't tell the difference between the message and the media. It's all tactilely blurred, but it's
right.
not blurred visually, as I was just saying. It's not kinetic blur. It's tactilely blurred, which means that you've gone into the accident that Lucy Run had. I mean, he's blind, and then he was in the blind squared, right?
Correct.
He doesn't see it.
Yeah,
coming.
Yeah. Yeah, so this we're actually circling back to where we started in this conversation, because when I was talking about 11, I was trying to talk about the fact that 11 couldn't be understood aside from gaps, the gaps of prime numbers as differentiated from non-prime numbers, or the gaps between the prime numbers themselves, or the gaps between the two ones that make up 11. So the what you're talking about by this blur and by the flip points, it always comes back to the gap and the fact that the last thing human beings want to do is enter into the gap in order to come to an understanding. But the only way to come to an understanding is by entering into the gap.
Yeah, so McLuhan meant that with his phrase, exploring ignorance for discovery?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was his motto for all the stuff he said. He'd come back to that.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's we're coming up near time, time to wrap up. So two more quotes that I have after what I've done. The actual quote just below, he's interviewed by Father Patrick Peyton, November 14th, 1971. We're focusing a lot on 1971 today.
That's right.
McLuhan says, I guess the guy asked, explain the medium as a message. And McLuhan goes, well, the medium. It's hard to know now where the medium begins and where it ends. Because, and then I don't think he finishes the sentence. I don't know what he says. But that's for him announcing the intermedia game he's playing. So
he talked a lot, and right in 1970, 1971, his main idea in those years was that the reason people didn't understand what he was talking about or didn't understand what anybody was talking about was that they didn't understand discontinuity.
Yeah.
And so he begins to talk about discontinuity in a whole bunch of different ways, one of which was to talk in terms of Yeats, especially talking about multitude. Because you can't understand multitude without understanding the intermedia, without understanding the borders that first define a multitude.
Yeah, was that where he talked about the phrase from Yeats, the emotion of multitude? Is that what you're thinking?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a very short, it's a one-page essay called The Emotion of Multitude.
And he gets into the subplot, which is your two lines, plot and subplot.
Absolutely. Yeah, which is the Apelion.
Yeah, there it is. So the next year, 2 years later, Collegiate Archive is 1970, I think, and then out comes Executives Take Today, the Executives Dropout, 1972. So here's
written in 1971.
Beg your pardon?
What'd you say? Written in 1971.
Right, and that's the year you're confronting McLuhan in his office about what you should do. Right? Was it 71?
I don't really know when it was. Nowadays, I'm leaning more to 1969, but right in that 1969, 70, 71 period, yeah.
Okay. I often ask Ion when these things happen. Maybe I'll ask, see if he can pinpoint it. Though they don't do time, but he can give a relativeness, a relative something, a relationship. So.
Yeah.
And that in 71 is when Morris is telling me they're retreating. Morris is not going to do the role that he had been doing in the public as a, quote, leader or put-on artist or the man who was the center of culture and technology. That's quite a center, to be the center for all culture and all technology, right?
Yeah, he was
dropping that role. So...
Here, yeah, 'cause he realized the center was decentered.
Yes. So this is a great line, great paragraph on page 137. I think this is maybe his very most complex statement. And we are doing that all the time. We've caught up to this complexity. So what he says, it's at the bottom of page 137, food for the mind is like food for the body. The inputs are never the same as the outputs. So, you know, what you eat is not the same as the output at the end of your digestion. This pattern of non-lineality, there's your discontinuity, this pattern of non-lineality is evident in every human activity. As figures, and he puts that in quotes, he's talking about our senses, as figures, all senses create their own spaces, which are metamorphosed by interaction with their environmental grounds. Grounds is in quotes. Now here comes the most complex statement maybe McLuhan's ever made. Or Barry did it. Causes, and that's in quotes, become effects, and effects is in quotes. But the next two words, via or via concepts, is italicized. So that's on another level. Causes become effects via concepts. So if you take McLuhan saying that the medium causes this, the radio caused World War II, to do that, you're turning it into a concept. And it just becomes an effect. Even though he has to say radio caused World War II, but your response to that, your conceptualizing of what he means that gets into problems.
Right. But we shouldn't say that that turns into a concept. It comes from a concept.
Well, that's what he says, via concepts. He says causes
become
effects via concepts.
That's right.
So you've lost the understanding or perception of the cause. It's just another effect, the way you've reduced it in your attempt to translate it into Gutenbergian lineality.
So yeah, causes and both causes and effects are in quotation marks because they have been moralized into singularities.
Yep.
Whereas, in fact, they're confused kind of fogs, each one of them. And so their relationship as complex fogs becomes very difficult and is what intermediality is.
Right. And you said fogs, F-O-G-S?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So what you were saying, you were shooting on everybody, is what he says after that statement. Causes become effects via concepts, whereas effects merge with causes, and they're not italicized, or in quotes, whereas effects merge with causes in process pattern recognition via percepts, but via percepts is not italicized.
Right.
See, there's a lot in that sentence there.
And neither are effects and causes in the last clause. Right, so causes and effects are both within quotation marks at the start of the sentence, and then they drop their quotation marks as he continues.
Well, they merge, so they don't become gapped. They lose their gap. Or is that making the gap?
No, vice versa. First off, the gap is always there. So it's a question of whether or not the gap is recognized and allowed to be operative.
Yeah.
Right? When causes are in quotation marks, that's an ungapped cause. And then that's related to a effect in quotation marks, which is an ungapped effect. So the two of them are ungapped on their own, and then their relationship is also ungapped. That's a concept. A percept is when these things are understood in terms of their gap plurality, and then they're no longer in quotation marks.
Yeah, gap plurality. You said gap plurality.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what's difficult for humans to understand is that when something comes into its clarity, which you could say is dropping its quotation marks, when it comes into its clarity, it contains an inherent gap, and it's complex and foggy, F-O-G-G-Y. So humans have a very difficult time understanding that illumination requires those kinds of darknesses. But that's just what human being is.
Yeah, humans, they might go listen to a presentation, a lecture or something, and they'll come out of it and say, I'm more confused now than I was before I came here. They don't recognize the services of that confusion.
Correct.
Yeah, good stuff. Our stuff, what we're doing now, past hour and a half or more, should be confusing the listener.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because we're, at least on my side, I'm pretty confused myself.
Well, I would never admit that, but of course,
no.
I'm very confused. See, I say it a bit in a different tone there, right?
Yeah, you're
confusing, but I'm really confused. Causes become effects via concepts, whereas effects merge with causes and process pattern recognition via percepts. Have you thought much about that sentence through the years, looked at it?
No, well, I'm very aware that in lots of your work, you emphasize that paragraph. And sometimes you just you'll say something like, this reminds me of page 137.
The sacred page 137. The archetype.
But when a person, one of the things that I think is interesting about talking to you or about reading stuff you've written is that it often repays thought. So thinking about this paragraph in 137 is an important thing to do.
Yeah.
And people should do it.
And nobody did do it. So I did it. I had to do it. Somebody had to do it. So I did it. So, yes, I'm emphasizing something. You might have read it, but you had not been thinking much about it through the years. You hadn't
read
it.
And so, you show that one of the ways, one of the most important ways to think about this is to repeat it and repeat it and repeat it.
Yeah.
But not repeating it mechanically, re-gap-peating it in a way that indicates that it's constantly being reconsidered, put into replay.
Yes.
All of these re-things are always at stake.
Exactly. And then I make an oral commentary below that. I say, referring to what this thing we've just analyzed via concepts and via percepts, that's McLuhan's most complex sentence intake today. I'm throwing that in because I'm starting to make a little more complex Global Village and calling it Global Theater, which I later, earlier tonight, called overlaying. I'm bringing in very rare quotations explaining that the Global Village is more complex than expected. It's actually the Global Theater, as you'll see in the following quotation. So what is, so then this quotation is interesting. And it's from Take Today Again.
Take Today.
Page 294. The extension, now this is italicized, the extension of the planet itself meant that the technology was not transported by individual or collective man, but by his previous environment, the Earth. Interesting. The extension of the planet itself meant that technology was not, it did not come from man.
Listen, Bob, this is one indication of how your writing indicates beyond itself. Because I hadn't realized it before, but I realize now that this quotation from 294 Take Today actually goes back to the Canubium quote from War and Peace, right? Because that Canubium quote is talking about the extension of the planet itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. So you're pointing out something very important here. Thank you.
Yeah, that's another quote you can add to that theme.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to take this quote and put it into a footnote in the Canubium of Being post and show how the this quotation is related to the previous one from the end of War and Peace.
Yeah, and you'll say, thanks to Bob Dobbs.
That's right.
I'll get
Bob,
a credit.
I'll say Bob deserves credit. My usual phrase for that.
Right, but that's what I'm proud of in terms of McLuhan's world. I'm pointing out stuff that nobody ever brings up. They don't even notice it. They're not working with McLuhan. If they were, they would be pointing out these particular quotations. They're very important, these ones, right? Isn't that what you're saying?
Sure.
So,
well, I'm not only saying that. I'm saying that there's a way. It's not a question of selecting quotations so much as a way of thinking with McLuhan that appreciates his complications.
Yeah.
And your thinking does do that. And then as part of that, it shows how there's certain key quotations that can help a person along that way.
Yeah, it helps them remain gapped.
And this is an example of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Remain gapped. All right, so we'll just finish up with this, and then we can end because you got to move on. So it became a total So this is a situation where the planet extended itself. It became a totally new game with new ground rules, ground italics. Our ground, italicized, now was literally in the sky. The ground was in the sky. Is that interesting? An aerial perspective had come to despotize, from the Greek despotein, which means for inclusive vision from above, is the Greek for knowing something inside out, which he has on page 136 of From Cliché Archetype. That is the British bias, to know something inside out. No, it's the American bias, to know something inside out. the British person says, I know it like the back of my hand. And there's eight cultural, what he calls plenary awarenesses. So I think it's the American culture that says, I know it's something inside out. So an aerial perspective had come to despotize. In other words, people thought they knew something inside out.
Whereas, I notice in the war, Putin is all often called a despot. Right? So that the despot comes from this Greek word, and it has to do, a despot is a person who controls a state or a situation. And so the very heart of the Gutenberg galaxy is the attempt to control a process. Could be an assembly line, could be the generation of an artwork, but the human being despotizes, becomes a despot over a process.
And you know who did that in the past couple of weeks? It was Elon Musk, when he brought in his Starlink to despotize the aerial perspective. He's trying to make the ground be, his ground be in the sky, where the ground is.
Right. But notice that at least for McLuhan, and arguably for Musk as well, it's not that the ground and the sky are being understood as a cause and effect in quotation marks or something.
Yeah.
They're being understood in the dynamic. And when the dynamic between the two is understood, then you can no longer despotize them in the sense of fixing them.
Yeah. Perfect. So then he says, whereas previous extensions had altered the speed of human motions in a great variety of ways, freely hybridizing with one another, the new extension of the planet seemed to call despotically for a new harmonizing of the spheres of action, influence, and knowledge. Now, that's what they call a great reset, or the New World Order 20 years ago, 30 years ago, right? They're attempting to harmonize it.
Yeah, but we have to understand that there's different kinds of reset.
Yeah.
Right? The great reset, if I understand it correctly, is a reset to a certain set of norms, set of law. And it's the law of Western civilization understood in a sort of American exceptionality.
Yes.
Whereas the reset that we're talking about, or that McLuhan is talking about, is a completely different reset from that.
Yes. The reset already happened. We got to understand
happened. Reset that's actually the ground of the world.
Yeah. So this is a good sentence.
A very good one.
Yeah.
The new as usual, you're saying more than you're writing.
What is that? My reach exceeds my grasp?
Yeah, that's right.
The new extension.
And grasp, you know that the word concept comes from grasp.
Ah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, the baby is starting to use their hands to grab onto something, right? The baby's always reaching out, trying to hold something, right? Grasp something. That's what I recall.
Yes, I think that's true. But the baby, in reaching out, comes to a new understanding of the world.
Yeah, that's how they understand. Yeah,
that's right. So the reaching out is gapped. It's the baby has to jump from an understanding of the world that is kind of womb based into an understanding of the world that is a social. Language, social structuring of the world.
Yeah.
So in the first counterblast in 54, McLuhan calls this, doesn't he say it's a lighting up of the night of the world? Doesn't he say something like that? But that's what language is?
I don't remember that. I'll have to look at that. Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So the extension of the planet itself is a new grasping.
Right. So remember in the end of War and Peace, what he's talking about is I forget the technical word for it, but he's talking about species either giving birth.
An outbreeder, inbreeder.
That's right. Correct. The outbreeder and the inbreeder. And he says there that now the world itself is becoming an outbreeder.
Yeah. Yep.
Right? And look at the two passages work very closely together.
Yeah, yeah. So he says that in 68, and 4 years later, he is checking what you might have done with page 190. You might have conceptualized it because he's saying this new Canubian that the world is arriving at, macro Canubian? His macro in there, can flip into despotically harmonizing the spheres of action, influence, and knowledge.
Right.
You see?
Right.
Are trying to harmonize these areas, action, influence, knowledge, and have no understanding of the ground of what it requires.
That's right. So that gets into the gap. But notice how this goes back to our discussion earlier this evening about the whole problem of trying to isolate the fundamentals and apply them. So here he's talking about the spheres of action, influence, and knowledge. And those spheres, plural, are what the great minds have entered into, and they've explored them. But when they've come to its communication, when they've come to its application, they haven't been able to do it.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a personal failing. It has to do with a failing of what it means to be a human being, what it means to be finite. But now that problem of this inability is hanging over us like the sword of Damocles.
Yeah.
We don't know what's going to eventuate out of that failure in the context of the war.
Yeah, the impulse to be the new pharaoh, harmonizing
yeah.
of the spheres.
So right.
These are great quotes coming up here. So it's going to be fun
yes,
to continue to explore these. These are really good.
That's right. It's difficult to fathom the genius that it took to isolate these things and to bring them into relationship.
Yes, by harmonizing a McLuhan is incredible.
That's right.
Okay, well, thank you very much,
good.
Cameron,
all
and
right,
look good forward to the next session.
And, yeah, we'll look forward to the next one.
Okay, great. Talk to you soon.
Yeah, remember you want to try and find the Peter Montgomery thing.
Yes, and also I'll look up Counterblast, and I'm going to make a note that we're starting at the top of page 89.
Yes, sir. All of the above.
Okay, great. All right, bye.
Good. Thanks, Bob.
You're welcome. Bye.